Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Chris Kander, author of The Weight of a Piano, published by Knopf in January. Chris is the writer-in-residence at Houston-based Writers in the Schools, an organization which works with children in reading and in writing. She's also written the novels Whisper Hollow and 11 Stories. In The Weight of a Piano, our protagonist, the piano, surrounded by a fine cast of characters, is a Blüthner upright piano. Upright because a grand would have been way too unwieldy for this story. This beautifully made and, for the most part, lovingly cared for instrument, and for the most part, carries, as it should, so much weight that it sort of bends the space-time around it in such a manner that the characters spiral about it, and each revolution are drawn closer and closer. Clara, Bruce, Greg, Katya, all are possessed and do possess something that is precious and valuable. And at the same time, it's not a curse or an albatross, but it's something that has to be carried. The idea of letting go or not is what makes this book, from the cover to the acknowledgments. And with that, welcome, Chris, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
So, first question, how did you choose a Blüthner piano? It's, you know, it's just not known in America. I know it's known in Germany. But what made you pick that particular brand?
Specifically because it's not known well in the United States. I wanted it to be, because I knew the novel was going to take place in the U.S. for a large part, I needed something that would be difficult to find. For example, if someone had been searching for a very long time for a specific piano, it couldn't be a Steinway or a Yamaha or something that would be listed on online auction sites or at every garage sale. It needed to be something that would be very difficult to find, but also was a treasure. And so I was put into touch with this wonderful woman in Los Angeles, a German woman named Helga Kasimov, who along with her late husband owned the oldest Blüthner dealer in the United States. And she talked to me about how incredibly beloved these pianos were, and the fact that they weren't just instruments. People who owned Blüthners in Europe and in Russia held on to them with both hands. In fact, I think it was Rachmaninoff, when he immigrated to the United States, said that there were only two possessions that he wanted to take with him. One was his wife and one was Blüthner. And so it was wonderful to learn the history of this instrument, to know about the factory in Leipzig, Germany, where it was made and where they are still being made, and to understand sort of the passion that goes into these handcrafted pianos.
What was really interesting about, especially at the very beginning of this book, and what you did was, you created the character. So you created the piano by explaining in a really kind of poetic fashion how it was made and the years it took to make it. And I know you got help, good help, in describing that. But it was so fascinating to learn not just the technique which came later, but just where. Talk a little bit about how you find it and tapping the tree and cutting the board and all that kind of stuff. That was fascinating.
Well, I loved learning that too, because I'm not a musician, but I do have reverence for how things are made. My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was a woodworker, and when I was very young, I didn't get to spend a whole lot of time with him, but I did understand, even back then, the reverence with which he dealt with his wood and the beautiful artifacts that we now still have, even though he's long passed. And so I could kind of understand how somebody who wanted to create something would do it with love and passion and integrity. And I learned a little bit about Julius Blüthner in the course of doing this research, and was able to kind of understand how he would go about selecting wood. Now, he didn't do that for every piano. He didn't go into the Romanian forest every single year. Of course, I took some poetic license. But there was a time, especially early, when he was creating these pianos and he was developing this, what they call a peerless golden tone, and how special and important it was to select the very finest wood in order to have this consistency that would become recognizable by musicians around the world. And the one of the things that I loved about writing that particular chapter, and thank you for the compliment about it, is that the Blüthner to me is the central, if not a central, the central character. And, you know, over the course of its life, and I think of it as a she, so over the course of her life, you know, she absorbs all of the emotion and all of the joy and pain and love that is expressed musically through her action. And the way that we as human beings become enlarged and retain these ghostly impressions of people and emotions and experiences, that's how I felt about the Blüthner in the story. And I felt like in order to do her honor, I wanted to go all the way to the beginning when she was just an idea in Julius Blüthner's mind, and then taking it through the process of crafting it and then launching it into the world so that she could take on this rich, full life for herself at the mercy of the people that would own her and play her and lose her and find her again.
It reminds me a little bit that the Walter Isaacson biography of Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs' father was a woodmaker, a furniture maker, and he was making a brake front, and he took the back of the brake front and finished it in as beautiful a fashion as the front of it. And Steve said, you know, why would you do that? No one's ever even going to see that. And he goes, because that's the way these things must be done. It was a lot like that.
Because he would know that it had been done right
exactly.
All the way through.
Yeah, exactly. You're paraphrasing exactly the sentence.
Yes.
I know you've spoken to this many times before, and as you tour, you will again, too. But talk a little bit about the story behind how this novel came into being. The idea about, you know, you going to the book club and talking about 11 stories and what that lady said.
I love that story because people always want to know where an author gets her ideas. And this is such a specific one. I have the exact moment in my mind where this idea was born. And it was simply that I overheard a woman telling a friend that she had found someone to take the piano that she had had since she was a child off her hands. But there was something about the way she stated it, that it wasn't just a casual, you know, discarding of an item. There was a lot of emotion in her voice when she said this. There was a lot of guilt, a lot of relief. And I just sensed that complication right then. And so I wanted to know more about it. And I went up and asked her if I could eavesdrop a little bit on it. And she told me that her dad had given her a piano when she was 7 and was providing her with piano lessons. And it was an expense. It was a challenging expense at that time in her life. But it became something so important to their family culture. And he would sit behind her on the couch during her lessons and when she practiced. And he really wanted her to have the opportunity to be exposed to art and culture in this little town in East Texas where she was growing up. And then suddenly, 10 months or so later, he died. And there was no money for lessons anymore. And the piano became the symbol of loss and of grief. And it sat in the foyer for a very long time. And when it was time for her to go to college, her mother asked her to take it with her. And so she carried it into this adulthood, never being able to play it, but because it was so freighted with emotion and so symbolic to her, she couldn't let it go. And as she got older, she realized that the piano wasn't her father and that she could try to let it go, but then it became a matter of how to let it go and what special way and to whom. And anyway, that concern of being the recipient of an item that is suddenly infused with so much meaning, but that doesn't fit into your life, was a concern that I wanted to explore in the form of a novel. And that's where the Weight of a Piano idea was born.
And it's so interesting because both Katya and Clara reach in different ways that same concept of letting go, not to spoil anything. But, you know,
Yes. But
that one interview in the, the one review in the New York Times told the whole story. Wasn't that horrible?
I didn't read it. I was very pleased to have a review in the New York Times. So nothing about it was horrible.
Well, but
I hope that it whetted a potential reader's appetite to learn a little bit more about the specificity behind it.
Well, I was glad I didn't read it till after I read the book, because in that second to last column of it, there were some things it said that I didn't think they should say, but that's just me.
And you I'm going to interpret it as enthusiasm on the reviewer's part and take it as a compliment.
It was. So, you know, in reading your website and things like that, I know about your interest in martial arts or, from, you know, at Taekwondo and fitness and all that. So let me ask you about Clara. Is there any of Clara's personality in you? And I don't mean in a bad way, but when she got kind of goes off on Greg, that in the one scene, when he tells her what he tells her, I was thinking, is that what she's like?
If you cross me. I am, you know, I really try to say that I say this, it's whether it's true or not is up for debate, but I don't think that I am, that any of my characters are autobiographical, but of course there are things that seep into their personalities that come from me. And I, of the two women, I identify more with Clara for many reasons. There was a time when I worked as a firefighter and I was the only woman in the fire station, the way that Clara is the only woman aside from the owner's wife working in this the auto shop. And Clara is not musical. I am not musical. My talent ends at being able to turn on the radio and appreciate music, but I can't play anything. I am pretty good with my hands. I'm handy and I'm pretty scrappy, and I definitely won't, you know, let anybody push me around if they stop me on the side of the road. So those are the kinds of things, the characteristics that I feel reflect me and my personality in Clara. But her circumstances and her life and her choices and the things that she ultimately decides to do in no way reflect the choices that I've made in my own life.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, and I know this isn't reflective of you, but it's reflective of a lot of people. And, you know, this idea of keeping your emotions in check, being afraid to commit to a relationship, both in terms of getting into one or refusing to get into one, you know, it always seems like it's traced back to a specific thing. And then there's always this other group of people that, you know, say to you, why are you going to therapy? Why are you doing this? Why don't you just get over it? And I wonder if there's a group of people that say, you know, yeah, Clara, this happened. Okay, but isn't it time to get over it and get on with your life? I didn't feel that way because I know the feeling she had. But do you understand that kind of feeling that people might have about her?
Yeah, and those are the kind of people in life that are well-meaning but probably, you know, misguided, because I think that people's pain is very individual and private, and we all process grief and loss in our own ways. And I think it's really, I think it's presumptuous of someone to tell another person to get over anything. That process takes whatever time it takes and whatever form it takes. And so I also strongly felt like when I was getting to know Clara, you know, she didn't really ever replace those intimate relationships in her life as she was growing up as an orphan. She had a best friend that she lost touch with. She lost her parents, and she lost everything that was familiar to her. And so she out of necessity, created something that was kind of a replica, not a replica of it, but a replacement. But it wasn't really, it wasn't emotionally a replacement for her. And so she kept her distance from people. She loved her uncle. She appreciated her aunt. You know, she engaged with the people with whom she worked. But I think that she just never got to the point where she was vulnerable enough for anybody to be that presumptuous to tell her what and how she should do to heal.
Yeah, it's like when someone's depressed and the other person says, hey, why can't you just be happy? You know, it's like, it's not something that means anything, and it's impossibility. But I'm not saying they don't mean well. I'm just saying it's...
No, sure. It's just a lack of understanding.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. So wasn't Peter, like, the most wonderful person?
Yes.
I mean, because you were talking about the garage, and it just made me think. And, you know, if you think of somebody who... There are certain people you meet in your life, my daughter being one of them, who are just themselves, you know? They're totally integrated. There's nothing vibrating around in their head. They're just themselves, and that's what they are. And that's what Peter was.
Oh, yeah. And I'll tell you a secret that's not so secret anymore. But the reason that Peter exists as he does is that he's modeled on my mechanic. I take my car about a half a mile down the street, the Travis Express Lube, and this store is owned by Greeks, and it is the mom was Anna and the son is Peter, and it is they directly influenced their characters.
Yeah, it's funny because my mechanic's the same way. Like, I do stupid things. Like, I had a 1998 Land Cruiser and a 1991 Crown Victoria wagon, and then I have this property that's pretty big, and I get the car stuck in the mud, and then I'd go down with the other car to tow it out, and I'd get that one stuck too. And then they had a towing business, so they would come out and they would laugh, and I said, why are you guys so nice to me? And they go, because you're stupid and you're really cool.
Hey, that's a great compliment.
I know. I like it. And then whenever I go there, I bring them donuts and coffee. And
yes.
It's a really nice relationship.
Yes, I love that.
All right, so we're trying to sell your book. Also, I have an independent bookstore, and your book is sitting right there on the front table. So.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome. And that, you know, that goes back to the cover, too, because as many people as tell me, you can't judge a book by its cover. Every single person who comes into my bookstore does that. And so the cover is great because it conveys both where the piano came from, kind of, and definitely conveys where it's going for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I think it's kind of an insider, it's beautifully subtle, especially after you've read the book, to understand the angle of the piano. And
yeah.
I love so much how the designer, who I think is brilliant, was able to suggest the piano without being obvious, and also incorporate the gorgeous, ethereal, and haunting landscape of Death Valley, which is such a central part of the story.
And it's funny because sometimes I wonder why Knopf and Doubleday and Scribner's and Penguin are so successful. And I realize because they're really good with their covers. The thing about it is that this doesn't appeal to just a segment of the population, like, for want of a better term, chick lit or something like that. It would appeal to anybody, you know? It doesn't alienate any segment of the reading public.
I think that it also, it's because there's so much, it's so subtle that it engages someone's curiosity. And so you're right, where some covers, you know immediately this is a romantic comedy, or this is historical, or this is science fiction. This really is so beautifully done and suggests so much that I think it inspires people's interest.
Oh, definitely. And I can tell because they pick it up. And when they pick it up, that's exactly what that means. And also, you did something that nobody else does, which is with Connor Scott. Why don't you explain a little bit about how he got involved and what he did? And I listened to that interview with the two of you also. Seems like a nice guy.
Oh, thank you. Connor is a wonderful guy. And I'll tell you about him after I tell you why I decided to do what I did. You know, the piano, I said earlier, she's such a central character. And in my mind, I felt like as she was growing older, and over the course of the novel, she's over 100 years old. And, you know, I have a lot of respect and reverence for older people because of the stories that they accumulate and the experience that they have. And I felt that same affinity for the Blüthner. And it was because I wanted to hear her expressing her own emotions in her own voice that I commissioned an original piece of music. And I decided to do this, you know, long before the book was even completed. I had written a first draft, and I was mentioning it to a friend of mine, and she said, well, why don't you reach out to my nephew? He's a young musician. He's trained as an engineer, but he's a brilliant composer. And so I reached out to him over email, and really without a whole lot of direction, just because I'm not a musical person, it was hard for me to find the language to express exactly what I was hoping for. He read a few chapters, and we talked about the kind of trials and tribulations that the piano would experience over the course of her lifetime and those of her contemporaries, Katya and Clara. And he came up with this gorgeous piece of music, which because of the way he wrote it and in that the melody, and it was so slow at first, and then it was just kind of reflective of this, the hands that changed and the way that the piano was treated, loved, and then lost, and all of these other things, and concluded in such a definitive and sparkling, haunting way. I could not have been happier with the way that this piece of music turned out. And so it appears, for those who haven't read the book, it appears at the end of the novel in the form of a score, but it is available for download directly on my website, which is chriskander.com. And I encourage people to go and listen to it because it's so beautiful.
It
deserves to be heard.
You know, the interesting thing about it is because there's so much music in the book and there's so much about Scriabin, so I listened to Scriabin's Prelude No. 14 in E-flat minor several times. And the interesting thing about that versus Derisa, the journey, is that they're two completely different, they put you in two completely different moods.
Yes.
And they couldn't be juxtaposed more clearly in my mind. And did you realize that when you commissioned the piece from Connor? Did you realize you were going to be creating something that was much more, I don't know, emotional and much more quiet than the Scriabin?
Yes, I did. I wanted it to be that. I also, when I chose Scriabin as the central piece, the prelude in E-flat minor, just like having to carefully select a make for a piano, I needed to carefully select a piece of music that would be readily identifiable by only a few people.
Right.
And I know that classically trained musicians know Scriabin well and have heard of this piece, but to me it was new. And the way that it expresses this wild, untamed emotion, this sort of, you know, like this exuberance and this anger almost, it's so energetic. And it was kind of reflective of a time early on in the story, and it became the central piece, almost the way that we're talking about a piano or an object being freighted with emotion. This piece of music became freighted with emotion and symbolic to Clara and then to Greg as well. And then I felt like it was important for the Derisa piece to reflect a broader scope of emotion, which I think it beautifully does.
And it's funny because Scriabin represents to me what Katya should have become, what she could have become.
Yes.
And where
yes.
Derisa goes into the past and describes her journey as fraught with all kinds of things that it was, you know? It was
very much.
Yeah.
Very much.
And it was also a risk for you to, one, put an actual score into a book, and then all the Cyrillic that you put there, translated sometimes, but not translated in other situations. And that's kind of a risk, isn't it, don't you think?
I mean, a risk in as much as it might confuse people, but I felt like the readers of this book are going to be intelligent, just because not everybody's going to want to read about an antique Blüthner piano, and so they're going to self-select on some level and probably give me the benefit of the doubt and stick with it. I felt like it was important to show, just like I wanted to show the Blüthner's voice in the form of this piece of music, I also felt like it was important to show Boris's relationship to Katya in that brief flash of Cyrillic. And of course, not everybody can read Russian, and so I needed to translate it, but I liked that it was there.
Yeah.
To me, it's a beautiful language. It looks beautiful, and I think that it adds a dimension to the story that otherwise would have been missing if we had omitted it.
Yeah, I know. Boris and Peter could have been other things in both of their lives. Well, maybe, well, never mind. I'll spoil it again. But it's funny how Mikhail, you know, and Clara's boyfriend, who she was leaving, or who dumped her, they start out a certain way, and in your book, as in life, they change. And I practiced law for some 30 years. I did divorces until I didn't have to do them anymore. And generally, wives would tell me what a jackass, but they would use stronger language, their husband was. And I'd always say the same thing. Was he like that when you married him?
Mm-hmm.
And it always gave them pause, because why would they have married somebody like that? Did they change? And you know, and what was it that made them change? And it's so funny, Mikhail wanted to go to, that's not how you pronounce it. How do you pronounce it?
Mikhail.
Okay. Mikhail wanted to go to America so badly, and then things didn't turn out exactly the way he wanted, but he also changed completely and changed with his feelings towards Katya. And, I don't know what point I'm making. It's just that it's always interesting to watch how people change in relationships.
Definitely. And I like writing about that because it is reflective of real life. And I think that Mikhail might have been a different person if he had been able to assimilate into American culture better, the way that so many other refuseniks came here and did so successfully. And I think had he not been thwarted in his big goals, and he was a narcissist to begin with, sugarcoat it.
Yeah.
But if he had been able to be successful the way he imagined himself to be, maybe it wouldn't have been so bad. But Katya met him in the middle too, because she, without giving too much away, her life was never the same after she left Leningrad. She didn't want to leave. And so there was this kind of crossing of paths and crossing of dreams that they never could reconcile again. And it felt to me very natural to write about that, you know, the devolution of what started as a potentially good relationship. And the same with Clara's parents. It was so interesting to write that chapter about seeing their marriage, I can't say too much, but immediately preceding their deaths, and how it had so clearly changed over the course of their 15 years together. And it reflects how, you know, people, if they often in relationships, and I'm not a marriage counselor, but, you know, it seems like people go through pretty typical rough patches, and if they can see their way through them to the other side, you know, they're better, they're happier that they stuck with it. Not in every case, but, you know, in the case of kind of nonviolent, just psychic malaise, you know, those relationships can go beyond the trouble and into something better. And in both of these cases, there wasn't an opportunity to do that. So it was interesting to kind of write half of that story in each of those cases.
Yeah, it's nice that you had so many interesting peripheral characters, even like Peter's mother and Peter's brother and Clara's uncle. But Alice was an interesting character because you have ambivalent feelings towards her, don't you? You know, like when she's leaning against the wall smoking the Virginia Slim and they're in that conversation. You kind of have two different kinds of feelings towards her, don't you?
Yes. Yes, for sure. She was a very interesting character. I liked writing about her a lot.
I bet.
I can't say too much because I think it would spoil it, but another strong woman, multidimensional, who's somewhat at the mercy of circumstance, and she's interesting to write about for sure.
Yeah, it's funny when you were talking about not assimilating. My grandparents both came from Belarus, and my grandfather came over and learned the language immediately, became a great success. But my grandmother never learned a word of English the whole time she was here. And maybe a couple words. Like we would come over to see her, my brother and I, in our car, and she would ask us if we came in the machine. And that was about as far as she got. And so their relationship, definitely changed because of that. She didn't want to be here, and she didn't want to learn about this country. But anyway.
Yeah, sad.
So one of the things we haven't talked about yet is Death Valley, which is something you're interested in, fascinated by, and you've written about separately. You've even taken pictures of tiny pianos in the desert. And it's, again, it's almost like a protagonist in the book, isn't it?
It really is, yeah.
Why? How?
Well, let's see. I had actually never been to Death Valley before I wrote this book. I wrote the first draft using research from photographers that I knew that had gone, calling park rangers, looking at Google Maps, Street View, and I could only learn so much at the time. But I knew that, you know, Clara, I knew that Katya had immigrated to Los Angeles and Clara had grown up there and was living in Bakersfield. And I wanted to have this journey, this symbolic journey take place in a location that would be reasonably accessible if you're carrying a piano. But I also love the idea of juxtaposing against a landscape that is so barren, and which Death Valley can be. It's very rich and full of life in many ways, but it's called Death Valley for a reason. And the extremes of it, the extreme heat, the extreme cold in certain places, the scale, the scope of it is unlike anything else. And I felt like this was a perfect place for Clara and the character Greg to go on this photographic journey. Greg wants to use the Blüthner in a series of photographs for his own personal reasons, and Clara, who has only reluctantly agreed to let him do it, impulsively tags along. And so, you know, it's during this 7-day period that the stories of the two women and their relationship to this piano begin to emerge. And it was a perfect location, and once I had finished the first draft, I had the opportunity to go and spend the exact same week in the park that Greg and Clara did in the novel. So I got to experience, you know, the way that it smelled at that time of year, and the way that the moon looked, and the way that the animals, you know, appeared or didn't appear. And it was really enriching and a beautiful experience. And I wanted to photograph a piano the way that Greg would, but I certainly didn't intend to carry a big one around with me. And so I bought a little tiny metal piano that's actually a pencil sharpener, and I took it around and placed it in all the same places that Greg photographed the eponymous Blüthner. And it doesn't look like it's a real piano, but the idea is there. And I learned how to, you know, play with the light and the angles so that I could have Greg do the same with the real one. And it was just a magnificent experience.
There were three things about Death Valley that you portrayed in the book that really interested me. Not interested. They were really good. So one of the three things that I thought were really good about the section in Death Valley was the first one, when Greg kind of comes around with Clara, and takes her to the lowest place on Earth. And I thought that was a kind of a pivotal moment in the book, wasn't it?
Oh, for sure. Very symbolic. He took her to Badwater Basin, which is 282 feet below sea level, and asked her if she had... I can't remember now exactly what he asked her, but it was a moment where he pointed out that she was at a low point in her life, literally and metaphorically. And she became aware of that double entendre pretty quickly.
And the other thing, again, without spoiling anything, because I always come close, is... When Greg says the unboyfriend. And that was when Greg turned, just like all these other guys turned. And he became this other thing at that moment, even after what they had experienced. And at that moment, right, he just turned into an... I'm not going to say the word. He just turned into a jackass, for want of something better. Right?
Yeah. Possessive.
And
where
super...
he tried to, you know, impose a change in Clara's life in that moment.
Right.
And with one word, kind of one moment, really decided that he was going to change the course of her life. And that was pivotal for her, and I wonder if we're giving too much away, but you know, part of the journey is her deciding whether she's going to continue to let people dictate the course of her life.
Yeah, and you know what? There's a decision made, and so the book ends, and you know, books can end in lots of different ways. You know, they can leave the reader with all kinds of questions like, what the heck just happened? What am I supposed to do now? Or they can be in a car, you know, they can be in a Christmas box all wrapped up in paper and a ribbon and tied up and that's it. And then they can be kind of like somewhere in the middle. And you wonder, you know, it's kind of like you may know what's happening and you are hungry for more. Not necessarily a sequel, but you have that feeling in your head, you know, I'd love to see what happens next. And that's the kind of book this was, right?
Thank you for saying that. I hope so. I like the idea. I don't, I personally don't care for stories that wrap up too neatly, nor do I feel like it's entertaining to make someone read 300 pages and then scratch their head at the end of it. So, but I do like to, I like to suggest a lot, and in that space for suggestion, allow the reader to meet me where the book ends and take it from there.
That's well put. That's exactly what I was trying to get at. And then the last thing, and we can end with this too, is the Sailing Stones. Do the Sailing Stones actually exist? Because I knew nothing about them.
They sure do. It's been a mystery for 100 years. There are these chunks of rock that fall off the cliff, and there's kind of this pentagonal shape on this very dry, packed earth. And over time, these stones move, and they create these shallow but very distinctive grooves, and they look like a wake. And at some point along the way, people called them the Sailing Stones, and forever nobody knew how they were doing it, because there are no footprints, there are no animals, there's nothing that really could specifically explain why this phenomenon existed. And unfortunately, or maybe happily, depending on how you look at it, the mystery was solved in 2014 when a group of scientists placed some GPS equipment and camera equipment on these rocks and left it, and determined that it was a fluctuation of temperature, that there was condensation that would freeze under certain circumstances, and then the rocks would slide very slowly, and then when the condensation would melt, they would stop, and these paths would continue at a very, very slow rate. So it wouldn't be like overnight you'd have a 20-foot trail. It was, you know, sometimes inches or centimeters, and yet they remain. They're very, very beautiful. The light comes in, and this long lake bed is incredibly flat. There is only about a 2 inch of one at the other, and so just as far as the eye can see, you see this gorgeous pattern on this hard-packed earth, and these big black glossy rocks, and these look like slug trolls behind them, and they're magnificent.
And yeah, and it's funny because I thought the first thing that came into my head when you started describing was the weight of a stone and just the idea of this thing moving itself across. But anyway, so I want to thank you so much. Like I said, the book will be in the front of the store. And if you, on your tour, come our way, or when it comes out in paperback, if you could come by and talk to us or maybe Skype with the book club, that would be great.
I would love that. It would be my honor to do that. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So, everyone, we were speaking with Chris Kander, whose book, The Weight of a Piano, just came out in January. It's an unusual book because when you pick up the cover, it could be about anything. And then when you dive in, the first few pages just grab you. And then after that, they grab you in a different way because it's completely different. And, you know, it goes from character to character, but it's not like one of those books where you go, oh, I want to get back to the other character. It's you're interested in each of them. And even though they switch back from chapter to chapter, the chapters are kind of short, so you don't miss your other one as much as you would in some other books. Anyway, it was a great book, and I really enjoyed speaking with her. So we have a lot of authors lined up. We're changing around the date, so I can't give you exactly who we're going to have here. But if you want a complete schedule as it arises, please visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com. You can go to the station's website, or you can simply download our podcast, and I think I'm finally up to date at iTunes or at Podomatic. So as always, thank you for sitting in today, and I look forward to having you all back with us next week on The Avid Reader.